court appreciates the council being available this afternoon. We know that was not your original intent, but the entire court was able to be here for the argument, and we thank you. And we're now ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Hernandez versus Gulf Group Lloyds.
May it please the court, Mr. Phil Barlow, this is an argument for petitioner. Petitioner has been served 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The issue before the court in this case is whether a strong legislative mandate and a stated public policy that has been announced on numerous occasions, but specifically in the Streisner case, favoring the underinsurance motorist coverage can be defeated if the insured does not get a consent to settle. And if that is affected, even though the insurance company is unable to demonstrate any harm or any prejudice from the insured settling the case without getting consent to settle. This is really, this is a first-time impression in this state. It is not a unique question, however. It has been taken up in many, many states, and virtually unanimously it has been held that in this case that the public policy will override the exclusion unless the exclusion the failure to get consent can be shown to have prejudiced the insurance company or harmed them.
Is there ever a good reason why a person would want to settle without contacting an insurance company? And is there a strategic reason to do that?
None that I could think of, Your Honor.
Was it just an oversight in this case?
I do not really know why it was not done. I just know it was not done. Obviously, it'd be a lot simpler if it had been done.
If we were to hold your way with this, would there be any reason why a rash of people would all of a sudden start negotiating their own deals without calling their insurance company?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because if the insurance company, under the holding of the majority of states in the United States, and so if the insurance company could show that they were harmed or prejudiced, then the people that, this rash of people that might be settling, would be out in the cold.
If they could show any assets now, they could clearly show harm or prejudice.
Yeah, they could. And they probably could show if they'd had any assets at the time of the, that the case was brought, or at any time in between, or at any time up until the present, or maybe in a reasonable probability of future assets they could show.
So if a person, for instance, is impecunious now, but is in law school, the insurance company would probably be able to make that showing. Maybe law school is a bad example, and medical school, like engineering school.
Yes, sir. I think the insurance company could have that showing. And while it is certainly true that the states have consistently upheld the validity of the exclusion on the consent to settle, they have also interpreted the legislative mandate and the public policy as saying, but you got to show that you are in some fashion harmed.
Under that law, then, there remains a disincentive for the insured to settle without consent. And that disincentive is there's always the possibility that the insurer will be able to come along and show prejudice.
Absolutely. And in many cases, without doubt, could do just that.
Is there any showing of prejudice in this record?
No. As a matter of fact, there is an absence of showing of any prejudice. In several respects, the defendant, non-responsible, financially non-responsible driver, was a 19-year-old boy. He had no assets then. The statement is he's never had any assets. He has no money today, and sees no reasonable way that he's ever going to get any in the future. In addition to his situation, the full primary limits were obtained in this case against the defendant, and Gulf has admitted and stipulated that they have never failed to give consent when the entire limits have been obtained. Furthermore, Gulf has also admitted that they have never obtained any money whatsoever in subrogation interest in an underinsured motorist case. there is absolutely no harm or prejudice that Gulf has been able to show. Now, what they have said, and I want to address that to the court, they have said, well, we may not have demonstrated any real harm or any real prejudice, but that you have taken a right away, a right of subrogation. That particular argument has been advanced in many cases throughout the United States and has almost unanimously held that doesn't quite get it, because it is, if there is no money to be recovered and no money that can be recovered in subrogation, then the subrogation is a meaningless and a hollow right. As the case in Florida, Ernest said, all of these are cited, of course, it said that right is only technical and illusory, and the lack of consent is demonstrably immaterial when there's no money to be recovered. The Illinois court put it another way.
Subject, have you ever taken a judgment that you felt was worthless because the person who took the judgment against had no money?
I have done so, but I have never collected a dime on anything.
Have you filed an abstract of judgment in those cases anyway?
I have done that. Again, though, my answer is the same. I've never gotten anything from them. And as a matter of fact, I really didn't do it anymore. But in my younger practice, yes, I've done that just as
okay. Well. Next question. There was some article in the newspaper today. An elderly man was mugged in New York City. And his mugger gets a $4 million judgment against the city for excessive police force and tracking him down. I assume that typically the victim decided not to sue the criminal because he'd never have any money. We find years later that here's the defendant who now has assets that could satisfy a judgment had a judgment been brought. How could an insurance company, if the insurance company has to come and say, gee, they should have assets, and they don't have assets now, how could they ever establish prejudice in a failure to notify a settlement? Obviously, if somebody says, I've got assets now, I want to settle with you, there's sort of collusion going on there. But in the typical case, where the insurance company offers, I'm willing to settle, here's cash, how could an insurance company that now has to pay because this person's uninsured ever establish prejudice on the circumstance where somebody in the future may have assets that could satisfy the judgment?
Judge Phillips' answer suggested the answer. Reasonable expectation. Reasonable probability. We do that all the time, Your Honor, in future medical expenses, for instance. You look at the past, and you look at what is the reasonable expectation or the reasonable probability of these future medical expenses.
Well, why should we, if we're just looking at the cost of the system, why should we put the system through? Why should we, the taxpayers, pay for trial time to make this kind of a guess, which may be complicated? It may be very easy, but it may be very complex whether this person's going to inherit some money or be disinherited or get a good education or be a wasteful. When there's a contractual provision and it can be very clean, you comply with it or you don't.
Legislative mandate and strong public policy would be my answer to that. That's why it is worth the effort. Because otherwise, you completely defeat and wipe out the citizen or the motorist who has been financially responsible and who is injured by an unresponsible person. You talk about strong public policy, and the Enabling Act says that it is for the protection of this, and so you have all of this legislative mandate, but yet you would be sweeping it away for a meaningless technicality.
Would the result be different if there weren't that public policy?
I think it would, Your Honor. Yes, I do.
Why should the provision be enforced absent the public policy any more than with it, unless there's a showing of prejudice?
Well, because I think you have to look at what was the legislature. Now, obviously, your jobs are to interpret the law, and part of that is what was the legislature trying to accomplish here.
But if you and I have a contract, and I fail to comply with some provision of it that does not affect the other performance or the alleged breach, that would not ordinarily excuse the breach. You would still have to show some connection between them. Why shouldn't that be the case here?
Because in that contract between you and I, Your Honor, I do not have a strong public policy on my side. I do not have an enabling act of the legislature saying we favor underinsured motorists. And in fact, we're going to require everyone to have it unless they do, unless they write that they don't want it. Because we want them to have it, and we want it to be effective. And I wouldn't have that in a contract between the two of us. I don't have all I have.
But, and so you're suggesting that, or you're saying that the situation would be different if you did not have the policy, the public policy.
Yes, sir. I did.
Then if you had not, if you'd settled without consent, you'd just be out of luck.
Yes, sir. I do say that. I believe that there is a difference with underinsured motorists because of what the legislature and this court, the precedent on this court, has said about we want people to have, to be protected. We want the financially responsible person to be protected from the unresponsible, negligent person. And you don't accomplish that by throwing out the case because of a technicality that does not harm the other side. Now, obviously, if it harms the other side, that's a different story altogether.
Mr. Harburger,
yes,
this may only be tangentially related to this case, but what, as I recall, there's a 4-year statute of limitations for suing your own uninsured motorist carrier, but there'd be a 2-year statute of limitations to sue the under a typical negligence theory. Under regular negligence theory, what happens when more than 2 years expires before the uninsured motorist carrier is sued? Are they precluded by limitations from suing the negligent driver?
I believe it would be a 4-year contract, John, because I think it sounds a contract rather than tort.
Yeah, the suit against the uninsured motorist, the insurance company, I understand that would be 4 years, but would the uninsured motorist insurer be able to join the negligent driver, or would that be barred by limitations? Since more than 2 years have expired since the date of the accident. I told you it was only tangentially related, but...
Yes, and I'm not 100% sure that I understand the question, Your Honor, and I'm sorry about that.
Well, it's because the question's not clear. In this case, there was the record... or the briefs indicate that the settlement with the negligent driver was within 2 years, but the claim against the UM carrier was more than 2 years, but less than 4 years after the accident.
That's correct.
And the claim here, of course, is the consent to settlement provision was breached, but I'm wondering whether that really makes any difference because the claim against the negligent driver would be barred by limitations. Is that better?
That's better, but that's better. I think that I believe that the 4-year would control here, certainly, because, in fact, even the insurance company's not going to do it.
Well, nobody could sue the negligent driver if it was more than 2 years after the accident, could they?
Nobody could sue the negligent driver directly after 2 years, I would not think. That's right.
And if that happened here, absent some tolling provision, and really the consent to settlement is kind of incidental because the claim might be barred by limitations anyway.
Well, it might be, and then perhaps that explains why. If you actually look at the amount of money that's recovered in subrogation under insurance, I think you're going to find most companies have about the same luck as Doug, which is they haven't had any luck whatsoever. There's a reason for that, very probably just in common sense, because the guy if he's irresponsible in not having and financially and putting himself in a position of being an underinsured, then very likely there may be other problems down the line of collecting against him, you know, after the accident has occurred. I do want to point out before I close here that state after state has approached this And the great, great majority of the cases say, well, that nothing is really being lost here. And certainly if the insurance company can show that they were breaking the law, then the exclusion stands. And the insured injured party is out of luck. But where there is simply the, as several states have put it, where it is simply an empty form, and I think the Florida court was talking about, the Illinois court was talking about, it wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on if you went ahead and took if the subrogation right was enforced. You get a judgment, it wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on, and no conscientious company would go to the trouble of doing it. Because of the attorney's fees and so forth involved, there would really be no use in doing it, so that therefore nothing is being lost here. And everyone's interests are still being protected. Thank you.
Any questions? The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Mary Mitchell will present her argument to the respondent.
Thank you. Mr. Hardberger is a very learned attorney and understands he's going to be hopefully joining the judiciary. His argument is very appealing. It appeals to one's emotions. But the consequences of this court reversing the Court of Appeals and doing what Mr. Hardberger wants you to do are threefold. At least I've thought of three reasons why the court should not reverse the Court of Appeals. One, by reversing the Court of Appeals, the court will ignore the legislative mandate contained within subparagraph 6 of Article 5.06-1 of the Texas Insurance Code. That's the Texas Uninsured or Underinsured Motorist Statute. Two, this court will ignore longstanding precedent of this court. And three, by reversing the Court of Appeals, this court allows insurers to convert underinsured motorist policies into primary automobile liability insurance policies. This is a risk that insurance companies do not plan for, certainly shouldn't have retroactive effect in this case. It wasn't too long ago in Guarantee County Mutual versus Klein that this court not only said that the consent to settle exclusion is consistent with Article 5.06-1, but that it advances the public policy of the state. The public policy of the state, while Mr. Hardberger announces one public policy, and that is that those who purchase underinsured motorist coverage should get paid benefits, there's an equal public policy contained within subparagraph 6 of the statute, and that is the legislature has expressly acknowledged the underinsured motorist carrier's right to subrogation. The legislature has never guaranteed to insurance companies, and I doubt you'll find one that would believe it, actual dollars in subrogation. The legislature.
Why isn't then the rule that the insurer can come in and show prejudice fully protective of that public policy?
Well, it's not in the exclusion, which was approved by the legislature's regulating arm, the State Board of Insurance, and the legislature has not so stated that as yet.
But insofar as you say there's a public policy argument here that is involved, cannot that public policy argument be fully addressed and satisfied by allowing the insurer to come in at any time and show prejudice by the settlement?
I personally think that is unworkable.
How
can you plan for anything? I mean, I frankly don't think an insurance company can show, if you consider prejudice, not obtaining money, as opposed to the right or the opportunity to obtain subrogation, then I think it would be almost impossible at any time.
And
you would have ad hoc decisions being made based upon the litigant involved and the contracting parties involved. And there's no guidance, therefore, to contracting parties or litigants for the future.
Any questions?
What type of standard does the insurance company use in giving up their rights when they agree to sell?
I wish I could answer that, Justice Spector. In this case, Gulf never had an opportunity to say yay or nay.
I understand.
But apparently they often consent. Sure, they evaluate whether there are other negligent parties out there, how good the liability case would be, because they stand in the shoes of the insured.
Does this record indicate what your carrier's policy was with reference to granting consent to sue when they were asked?
Yes, sir. I believe in the transcript, and the page number escapes me, but it's in one of the stipulated findings of fact, if I'm not mistaken, that Gulf always investigates the assets and goes through a procedure in determining whether to consent or not to consent or whether to obtain a judgment against the negligent driver or any other parties that may be legally liable. In this case, it's been stipulated that Mr. McCullough, the son, was the sole proximate cause of the accident. And so in that case, we're limited to looking at him and his financial assets. Gulf did not do that after the fact because they were presented with the claim over 2 years after the accident, did not even know about the accident, did not have an opportunity to conduct any type of investigation. It was all years past after they got the claim.
But you've not been able to show any prejudice that resulted.
Well, Justice Heck, I think there is prejudice. I think there's prejudice as a matter of law. When they settle with the negligent driver 2 months after the accident, our right to subrogation disappears. It was destroyed.
But if it's, period. If it's a worthless right, it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, I don't think it is a worthless right. I don't think it's form over substance. The legislature thought it was at least of some importance enough to put it in a statute.
If you could show that it was worth something, it would help us dispose of this case.
I understand, and it may be that, can we say that a judgment is worth nothing? We could have gotten a judgment which may or may not be collectible in the future. And isn't that a risk that Gulf should take?
If it were truly shown to be worth nothing, would your position be any different?
No. Because I believe this court should adhere to its precedent in the Members Mutual Insurance Company versus Cupaya case, which was decided 21 years ago, and defer to the legislature and or its regulatory arm, the State Board of Insurance, to make that decision whether material prejudice, in fact, should be rewritten into the policy.
Apart from questions of public policy, just as a matter of simple contract law, not every breach of a contract excuses the other party's performance.
Correct.
Only a material breach. If there's no harm from a breach, if you accept that there is no harm in this case, why should payment of benefits be excused simply because that provision has not been complied with? Not as a matter of public policy, just as a matter of simple contract law.
Well, I guess I'd have to agree with you as a matter of contract law. Here, I think, as Mr. Hartberger thinks, we have public policy coming into play. And I think that's important. I agree with him on that point. We just happen to have conflicting public policies. And it's fair to say that the public policy, as he has set it out, is to pay insured is dependent on coverage.
Do you agree that this breach is immaterial?
No, I think it's material as a matter of law.
So you disagree with Mr. Hartberger on more than just whether public policy decides this case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think losing a right is not immaterial, period. At least a right that the legislature decides is of some importance. We can argue all day about whether the legislature is right in saying an underinsured motorist carrier should have a right to subrogation. But as you said, Justice Cornyn, in Johnson, the recently decided Johnson, they said it. It's there. It's there in the statute. It's not for us to evaluate whether the legislature is right or wrong. They can certainly change the law. And that's what happened in the case leading up to the Cutea decision of this court. The petitioners came in and asked the court to impose a material prejudice standard in the notice condition of an automobile liability policy before it would bar coverage. And in that case, the facts were different in a sense in that the insurance company came in and defended, reserving their right to deny coverage based on the notice condition. Their insured lost, so there was potential liability under the policy, and they said, you know, came back. You breached the notice condition, and we're not going to pay. And the petitioners came in and said, but, you know, you should be harmed by this. You weren't harmed by this, by our lack of giving you notice. The Supreme Court said, well, there's an injustice here, but it is not for us to rewrite this policy and impose this requirement into a provision that the legislature or the State Board of Insurance, might have been the State Department of Insurance at that time, didn't seem fit to include. Now, shortly after that case came out, that's what the State Board of Insurance did. They issued an endorsement that said, you know, you're going to have to show prejudice before you're going to rely on the notice condition to bar coverage.
Since your client was not notified until after 2 years,
right,
more than 2 years after the accident, would you have been barred from suing the Mr. McCullough by limitations?
We would have probably barred from suing anybody if there was anyone other than Mr. McCullough, as well as Mr. McCullough. But since we, as the subrogor, stand in the shoes of the insured, because the insurer released liability from Mr. McCullough and his father for the payment of $25,000, we would be bound by that release and could not go against Mr. McCullough anyway.
But by virtue of the expiration of for the 2 years, you might be barred,
sure,
from suing Mr. McCullough by limitations,
oh, sure,
irrespective,
absolutely,
of the consent to settlement provision.
And if there had been a, you know, another negligent tortfeasor out there, we would have been barred too.
Does that affect the contractual rights of the parties, or is are the Hernandezes entitled to do that, which accomplishes the same objective, I suppose?
Well, the Hernandezes are entitled to sue us for benefits under the policy, since it's a contractual claim, and you know, we either have a good reason to avoid coverage or not under the terms of the policy. I think we do under the exclusions, but I don't know how the statute of limitations could directly impact us in another form,
well,
other than an equity form.
It would have the same practical effect,
sure,
wouldn't it,
mm-hmm,
that you'd be barred from suing,
right,
Mr. McCullough?
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that that you know of, is there?
Well, you know, I don't think
nothing
I'd
legally
like it,
wrong with
but
it.
It's inequitable, it's unfair, I suppose. But as far as citing you a case or something that would show how bad it was, I couldn't do that justice.
Why did the Court of Appeals not address the prejudice argument?
Boy, I don't know. I couldn't tell you justice. They came in. We had argument, if I'm not mistaken, about a month after the Klein decision came out, and the three justice panels started firing on Mr. Zinn about the Klein decision immediately and simply asked me if I thought it applied, and I did. I did. But I don't know why they didn't address it. It was certainly argued and briefed. Finally, if the this really isn't about whether Gulf could get money, dollars. This is really about who controls this situation. Who has the right to extinguish another's right? The legislature, I believe, has given that right to Gulf, to either consent or not consent. Pony up. You know, have Gulf have the risk involved in consenting or not consenting. If you give an insured the opportunity to unilaterally decide that the right to subrogation is going to be extinguished, you essentially make the underinsured motorist policy into a primary auto insurance policy. because the underinsured motorist coverage is a supplemental coverage. You don't have to buy it. Instead, you don't want to. You have to formally write out that you're rejecting the coverage, but you certainly don't have to purchase it. And certainly the premiums are different for primary insurance coverage as opposed to excess coverage, which is what the underinsured motorist coverage acts as. It's a supplement. It's on top of the coverage available to the one who's primarily responsible for the insurance damages, and that is the negligent tortfeasor. So you allow the insured an incentive to let the negligent driver off the hook for X amount of money by allowing the insured the unilateral power to eliminate a right to subrogation. I don't think the legislature mandated that result. And in this case, the petitioners held the key to coverage. They could have picked up a phone and given Gall the opportunity to say yay or nay. They didn't do it. They opted to risk their coverage. Did the red light go off? Oh, no? Okay.
You don't need to use all your time.
But in any case, they're the ones in control. Gulf has been harmed because there's no future collectability. And Mr. McCullough can say, well, I don't think I'm going to make any money in the future, but we don't know that. We're guessing. Mr. Hardberger and I were both judgment proof at one time, and I'm sure I probably still am. But that doesn't mean that this court should impose an ethereal standard that shifts depending on who the litigants are, the contracting parties are, whether they have assets when they're 19 years old. I think it's unworkable. And I request that, in conclusion, that if the court reverses court of appeals, under the facts of this case, I think it'll be against the public policy of the state as set forth by the legislature and would be inequitable, frankly.
Do you agree that the weight of out-of-state authority?
No, I don't agree with that. Actually, the majority of jurisdictions enforce the exclusion as it's written, with strict construction, and that the issue of prejudice hasn't been presented in most jurisdictions. So we really don't know what the majority of jurisdictions say about this. The Iowa Supreme Court has said what Mr. Hardberger says they said. And in a variety of jurisdictions, such as North Carolina and Florida, the legislature has devised a system whereby the insured presents their claim for underinsured motorist benefits. The insurer has an opportunity in a certain limited amount of time to investigate and decide what they're going to do. And then therefore some of the cases really support the legislative mandate as set forth by the legislatures of those states. I think this court has enough precedent on its own to follow the precedent in this case, in this suit. The Klein decision clearly says the exclusion is not against public policy.
Do you think the insurance company can unreasonably withhold consent?
Not at all. Not at all. And in fact, I would dare say Mr. Hardberger might have a better case if we had done that, because he would be subject to a bad faith lawsuit and treble damages, et cetera. So, no, I don't think an insurer can unreasonably withhold its consent. That issue, of course, never came up because we never got a chance to consent or not. And that's the problem. We're looking back, we're looking forward, we're saying what Mr. McCullough would have done, what we would have done in the past, and that's really not, I think, workable in a day-to-day setting for insurance companies or insurers, for that matter. The insurers knew what the policy said.
Did I understand you say that you believe that your
position with reference to making any recovery against this particular insured was so weak that you would have been subject to a bad faith lawsuit if you had asserted it?
No. I think I meant to say, if I said that, I didn't mean that. In response to Justice Spector's question about unreasonably withholding consent, no, I don't think an insurance company can do that. We did not get the opportunity to consent or not, and if we had unreasonably withheld consent, I meant to say that Mr. Harberger's case might be better for him as far as damages go.
Well, wouldn't it be unreasonable to not consent for someone who had this kind of asset record?
I don't know if it would or wouldn't. Tell you the truth, we never got the chance to make the decision, and I frankly don't know what Gulf would have done. I have a feeling, this is my gut reaction, Justice Doggett, is that they would have taken a judgment since the against the negligent driver since the limits were so high, which $100,000 in limits is fairly high for underinsured motorist coverage, and so I think they would have preserved a right to subrogation.
Well, in the record, is there that same investigation made 2.5 years later?
The investigation which was done was to look into what happened. When, you know,
are there now assets available?
They did not conduct the asset investigation after denying coverage. No, they did not, as far as I know. Now, I don't know that that's in the record, actually. I think what the record contains is what Gulf usually does. And what they did in this case was, in the course of their investigation, they determined that the exclusion would apply and they denied coverage.
So they stopped there.
They denied coverage.
See if perhaps they were prejudiced because, as Mr. Harberger suggested, he might have won the lottery.
Well, you know, I'm sure they didn't
pursue
in a prejudice analysis, and I don't think Gulf thought that was the law at the time, to tell you the truth.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Larry Zinn will present the rebuttal.
Mr. Zinn, may I ask you, in Johnson, which your opposing counsel alluded to a moment ago, and in Streisner, and in all the other cases in this area where the court has said a contractual provision must fall because it conflicts with some public policy articulation by the legislature, the court has said it conflicts with the statute. Are you making that argument here that this provision conflicts with the provision of any Texas statute? Or based on some more generalized argument based on what public policy created or recognized or articulated by that statute is?
We're relying on the legislative mandate stated in the statute and the public policy stated by the legislature in the enabling legislation of the Uninsured and Underinsurance Act, and then the precedent of this court in interpreting and applying and enforce that legislative mandate and legislative public policy. Because the legislature stated both in the statute and in the enabling legislation that the purpose of the act was not to give Gulf subrogation rights, it was to give citizens like the Hernandezes protection in this kind of circumstance. And it was to benefit, their language was, all the citizens of the state. This was in the enabling legislation of the original Uninsured Act in 1867. And in the Act itself, it states that that this is for the protection of motorists and citizens who are injured by financially irresponsible motorists who are negligent.
If Gulf could show some chance of recovery on the subrogation claim, would that be a showing of prejudice?
I think it would.
Any chance?
It has to be within the, you know, like any other claim, and it honors the evidence, reasonable probability.
Anything less than far-fetched?
Sure. I mean, Mr. McHale, I suppose, might win the lottery tomorrow, but the odds aren't good. And the state of the stipulated facts in this case are that, and Gulf stipulated to this, that they had not been, that they had not suffered any financial losses with regard to its segregation rights, and that due to McCullough's financial situation, McCullough was the negligent driver. The pursuit of a subrogation claim against him would have resulted in nothing but a personal judgment against McCullough, which up to the present was uncollectible. That's one of the stipulated facts in this case. And the evidence in this case also shows that he had absolutely no assets other than this policy up until the time of the trial. And the trial occurred almost 6 years after the accident. And the stipulated facts are also that McCullough did not believe the situation would change in the future. Gulf presented no evidence to the contrary, and there's no evidence in this record to the contrary in the stipulated facts.
Mr. Zinn, if you are representing an injured plaintiff individually in a claim, and you are presented with the possibility of settling within the policy limits, would you not, as the attorney for your client, let's assume liability is clear, for want of a better term, it's fairly certain this guy's going to get tagged, would not one of your assessments as to whether or not to settle be the possibility of recovering against individual assets?
Yes, and you can be sure that, well,
okay.
Excuse me.
Now, so then you determine let's settle because the likelihood of recovering from any other assets is pretty limited. And you settle without the really minor technicality of notifying the insurance company to let them have a chance to look at it themselves. So you settle. How could the insurance company, under those circumstances, and I dare say that would probably be the par for the course. That would be how this would come about. What possibility would there ever be for an insurance company to come forward and establish by preponderance of the evidence of some sort of, I don't know, reasonable expectation of recovery or maybe recovery, or in the face of the plaintiff's lawyer already making the determination that there's not a likelihood of recovery?
You can be sure that if there was another thin dime to be had from Mr. McCullough, we would have got it. We investigated it. We're not going to settle in a death case for $25,000 in insurance policy and give him a full release unless we thought there were other assets. Now, we did our investigation. As far as the insurance company, why do you want to protect a worthless right and destroy a right that is legislatively given to citizens on the basis of, again, a right that has absolutely no worth? Why?
I guess I'll ask you this question. You have never taken a judgment that at the time you thought it was worthless, but later on, because of an abstract of judgment or something, you found it could be collected. You've never had that experience?
No, and when I took Little League dog cases, when I started out, I pursued everything to judgment and then pursued whatever I can for my clients. Much like Bill, and I've been in practice a lot less than Bill, I've never made a thin dime, nor have my clients. It's just the hard reality. And there are going to be situations where the insurance company will be able to show prejudice. This is a clear case, absolutely clear case, when they couldn't. And the insurance company is asking you to enforce absolutely worthless right to overcome the stated legislative right of their analysis.
Any questions? Thank you, sir. That concludes the arguments in this cause and concludes the court's oral submission docket for the day. All of the foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise. Oye, oye, oye.